we would go 2, 3, 4 hours almost to the Scottish border. We were so desperate, you see, to see the tiny work grow. We were understandably perhaps a little too desperate, being young, and on occasion we would embroider things a little and go out to visit people who hadn't actually asked for a visit at all, maybe hinted at it, you know, vague hint, and we would go to see them. Now that is against policy, and we were not supposed to do that then, nor do we do that now. But we were, you know, I was 21 and he was maybe 22, and we were still in AC, and nobody really knew we were doing this anyway, so we did it. They knew we were visiting, but they didn't know how desperate we were. One day we got a letter in the mail from a person who identified herself as Miss Amy Thorpe. And Miss Amy Thorpe had been receiving the plain truth, which she said she had not asked for. Apparently somebody had, you know, sent in her name and had, as people will do, pretended to be her. And so we put her on the list, and she'd gotten the magazine for a year or so. And in her letter, Miss Amy Thorpe stated the following. She said, "I receive your magazine, though I never requested it. I've never read it. I stack them neatly in a corner of the living room." She said, "I've been a member of the Church of England for 72 years since I was born." And she was probably christened there and all of that. And she said, "I feel no need to receive literature from other churches. I'm perfectly happy with the church I'm a member of. But I do thank you for sending it anyway." She said, "You've spent money on the paper and the postage, and I thank you for it." She was a very proper lady who thought she should tell us that. But then there was a P.S. at the end of the letter. In the P.S. she said, "If you're ever in Birmingham, please feel free to come for tea." Now you understand the context. Miss Thorpe was just being polite, you see, as the British tend to be. The British are very polite. They always ask you to come to tea, hoping, of course, that you won't come. But they will tend to say things like that, come to tea or come for tea. I decided to interpret the P.S. as a formal visit request. So the next day, I drove 130 miles, not all that far, up the M1 in the little green College Anglia and knocked on her door at 4 p.m. I thought that was a good, appropriate time to come to tea, or, you know, and told her, Miss Thorpe came to the door, and I told her I had come to tea. She had invited me. She seemed a little surprised, but she was convivial. But on entering the home, it was my turn to be surprised. You see, there was not just one Miss Thorpe, there were actually three Miss Thorpes. Spinster sisters, all of them in their 70s. None of them had ever been married. They had lived in the house, they had been born in that house, in fact. It was their father's house. They'd lived there all of their lives. They were all three lifelong members of the Anglican Church, Episcopalian Church in the USA. And perfectly happy with it. Amy, I think, was at that point 70. And Kathleen was 73, and I think her name was Mary, and I forget the name of the older sister. I think it was Mary. She was about 75, so 70, 73, 75, all of them very prim and very proper and very English. They had me sit on what they called the settee, which you would probably call the divan or the sofa, but they called it the settee. So I sat on the settee, and they served me some very good tea. They also served me some excellent chocolate biscuits, which I've never forgotten. Now, biscuits in England are cookies to you Americans, but they call them biscuits, and they're incredibly good. And they also served some very memorable Scottish shortbread, which I think they had bought, but it tasted homemade. But I remember it to this day. It's only 27, 28 years ago. Now, you have to understand this, I was a 21-year-old starving Ambassador College senior. Now, college food is wonderful, but it is never, never sufficient in quantity. Quality is sometimes wonderful, and nowadays, of course, there's lots of quantity, too, and there are people here involved in that particular area. But in those days, we were always starving to death. So for 3 hours, I sat and ate chocolate biscuits and Scottish shortbread. They told me how happy they were with the Church of England. They had never missed Vespers since they were 3 years of age. And, you know, they gave me the whole history of it. Well, finally, I recognized that these spinster sisters were not being called of God. That was quite clear. They had no interest in the church at all. There was no understanding. And the plain truths were neatly stacked in the corner, just as Miss Amy Thorpe had said they would be. So I decided to just talk about their lives. I mean, make the best of it. What else could I do? I delved into the past. We talked about World War I, World War II, which they remembered, you know, in detail. We talked about their jobs. They had been spinsters, so they had been allowed to work. Women of their generation didn't tend to get jobs, but spinsters did, and they were professional spinsters. That is, they had never had any intention, any of them, of getting married. And so they had worked. They'd been nurses, I think, or something of the kind. We talked about jobs. And inadvertently, because I didn't know what I was doing at the time, inadvertently, without even realizing it, what I was doing, I had begun to honor them and validate their past accomplishments. I didn't know I was doing that. I was simply eating chocolate biscuits and shortbread, you see. And since there had to be conversation, and they knew nothing about the church, I thought I would ask them about themselves. So why not? I stayed 3 hours. They kept telling me about themselves, and then I left. I was a little discouraged and a little angry at myself when I left for having misinterpreted that P.S. at the end of the letter. I mean, I drove back to London. That was 130 miles. I'd spent gas, petrol to the English, going up and back, and time. And I had begun to feel somewhat guilty about this, as I should have. And I felt bad. Well, that was the end of that, and I thought I would never see them again. A week later, I was at work in the office, and I'd open up the little pile of letters that had come in that day. And there I saw a letter with my name on it, and my name was on the envelope, and it said urgent in big letters. Now, the British understate things. They don't tend to put urgent in big letters unless they really mean urgent, you see. They do not do things like that unless something dramatic is going on in their minds. I opened the letter. It was from Miss Amy Thorpe. And she said, and I can almost quote it verbatim, she said, "My sisters and I want to ask you some questions about your church." She said, "Please come to tea again soon." Now, I read that letter at about 10:30 that morning, and by 2:30 in the afternoon, I was in the Little Green Anglia, and I was going up the freeway, up the M1, the motorway, to Birmingham. When I got there, I was shocked by what I found. I sat down on the settee, and the pile of unread PTs in the corner were no longer neatly stacked in the corner. They were spread all over the little living room, and they were very clearly, obviously, being read. I was even more dumbfounded by what Miss Amy Thorpe said to me. She said, "You know, my sisters and I were so impressed by your willingness to come so far to have tea with three old ladies that we decided to find out more about your church." She said, "You know, we've asked the local vicar, the local Church of England vicar, to come to tea at least a dozen times, and he's never come. And you came the day after you got our invitation." She said, "He was so nice to have somebody talk to us. And we've decided your church must be a very special organization if members of your church show so much attention and respect to little old ladies." She said, "Tell us what your church is like." So I did. I really did. In my youthful enthusiasm, or perhaps better stated, in my youthful stupidity, I told her everything about the church I could possibly think of. I told her all about first tithe, second tithe, and third tithe. We went into tithing in detail. Now, you know that was not appropriate, but I told them all that. And they sat there with their eyes wide. They'd never heard of first tithe, much less second or third. I explained about the Sabbath. They'd never heard of going to church on Saturday. They had never heard of that. And their eyes got bigger and bigger. I told them all about the holy days one by one. I just, you know, ground through the holy days. I lambasted Christmas, and I went all through Nimrod's history, what he did. And, you know, all the sacred things in their life that they loved and were so attached to. And these three little very proper English ladies sat on the settee opposite me with their eyes wide and said nothing for 3 hours. Though Kathleen did go back to get some extra chocolate biscuits once or twice. But they just sat there. And I dumped everything on them. And at the end, these three little English ladies looked totally dazed. I finally realized I had better leave quickly. I had, you know, it finally struck me. I'm slow on the uptake in these things, but finally struck me that I had probably said much too much and I should leave. So I did. And as I was going out the door, Amy Thorpe looked at me and said, "Where does your church meet in Birmingham?" Now, I didn't want to offend her, but she wasn't ready to come to church. People need a foundation. And I thought, what'll I do? I thought, well, I'll talk real fast. I'll tell her where it is real fast. And she had a hard time understanding my accent anyway, somewhat. And so I said to her, well, it's in the Arden Hotel, and it's in the center of Birmingham, you know, near the bullring. And I was going out the door. And Miss Amy Tharp looked at me and said, fancy that, they meet in a hotel. I've never heard of a church that meets in a hotel. She'd gotten it. I never thought I would see them again. I drove down the M1, you know, in the little green Anglia, feeling ridiculous, and which I should have because I was, and feeling stupid and kicking myself for my lack of wisdom for all of it. And that, I thought, would be the end of that. I would never hear from them again. Next Sabbath, I went to church in Birmingham. Now, even though the college was near London, as a student, I was also the assistant pastor of the Birmingham church. We did lots of things in those days. So it was my job to drive back up in the Green Anglia on Sabbath and be at services, which I did. And I walked into the hall, a little tiny congregation of about 35 people in Birmingham. And guess what I saw sitting in the front row? Yeah, all three Miss Thorpes, all of them with little tiny, you know, Church of England hats, little hats all in a row, looking very prim and very proper and very interested. Well, I baptized Amy Thorpe about 6 months later, and then Kathleen was baptized about a year later. And Mary, who was the oldest one, held out a little bit longer. It took her about 2 years, but she was baptized too. That's over 27 years ago. Kathleen and Mary died in the faith in the late 60s, so that's been a long, long time since they died. Amy is still alive, amazingly. She is 96, 97, 98. She is a lady of very great age. I went to Birmingham 3 years ago, first time I'd been there in 27 years. I was going through the UK, and I drove up to Birmingham, up the M1. Didn't drive a little green Anglia this time, though. Slightly larger car, fortunately. Those Anglias were killers. And there in the front row, there she was, same hat that she'd had on, I'm sure, almost 30 years previously. That hadn't changed, looking very prim and very proper and very, very interested. Afterwards, she invited me to come to tea. I wish I could have gone. I didn't have the time to go. I had to go back to London to get a plane to go to Europe. And she said to me, do you remember those first visits you made and the tea and the biscuits and the conversation? And I'm thinking to myself, do I remember? I hope you've forgotten, but I remember. But the point is this, you know why they got interested in the church? You know why? The point of contact, what God used. But you might say the stupidity of an Ambassador College senior didn't know what he was doing, but there's a little truth in that. God used the honor that came through. Without knowing what I was doing, I honored them by accident. That is, I simply sat there and I talked to them for many, many hours about themselves, and then I validated, unwittingly, again, the things they had accomplished in life, and somehow it filled a void. The local vicar wasn't doing that, you see, and they then unconsciously compared me, in my stupidity, to the vicar, I'm sure, who had a dozen great degrees and maybe even a doctorate in something or the other, but he hadn't validated them, he hadn't given them honor. Honor brings dramatic results. One problem I want to address, though, very quickly, that can make dealing with the elderly problematic if you begin to do this. Elderly people do tend to ramble. That is, they will tell and repeat certain stories over and over again. And you think, no, here they go into that same story about when Granddad, you know, moved out to Mojave in 1929 and bought a store, and I've heard that so many times, and I wish, you know, and you look for an excuse to get out. You shouldn't. Sadly, a lot of young people misunderstand what is happening, and they just tune out because they view this as, you know, futile rambling, the elderly ramble. No, they're not. You got to understand what is occurring, the dynamics of this. I remember on those rare occasions when I visited my maternal grandfather. He died when I was 7, the only grandparent I had. All the other three died before I was born. My mother and his daughters, my aunts, would go and visit him on Father's Day. They would go see Dad, as they called him, on Father's Day. That was the one time in the year when they went to see him. He lived within 10 minutes of their homes. He was in a hospice and an old folks home. But that was the only time they ever went to see him that I was aware of. They never brought him to the house because he would get in the way, and they preferred not to have him around. During those rare visits, he would spend much of the time reminiscing about Scotland, where he was born, and talking about the boat that brought him and several hundred young immigrant Scots to Canada, to Halifax on the East Coast, and dumped them there, and then the Canadian government put them on trains, all these young guys in their late teens and early 20s, he was 17, and hauled them all the way across North America to Manitoba and Saskatchewan. That's up above North Dakota and Montana, for you, those of you who don't know Canadian geography. And then they dumped them off the train and said, now you can go homestead, go and farm. There's free land out here. Most of these young guys had come from industrial towns like Dundee. They were not farm boys, they were city boys who didn't have any idea what farming was all about. They wanted a job in a factory, but, you know, they would dump them off on the prairies and say, homestead. My grandfather didn't know what a cow was, you know. And he would talk about that in his first job on an Indian reservation as a policeman in 1911. When all this would occur, my mother and my aunts, her sisters, would sort of look pained and turn away because Dad was off on those stories again about when he arrived. And they would ignore his need for honor. The rambling and the rehearsal, brethren, of past events is a request for you to do something. It isn't just a storytelling thing. They're setting you up to give them honor. But to get the honor, they got to tell you something they've done that they feel is worthy of honor, you see. They are saying, in effect, give me some recognition, some dignity, some validation for what I've done in life, for what I've accomplished, so I can come to a sense of peace with the past, you know, and come to closure, come to completion. Tell me it was worth living. Now, if you ignore that and you assume they're just rambling and you cut them off, or you get up and go out for a beer, or, you know, you walk out of the house and leave them, you can create or you can exacerbate a feeling of futility and strip them of dignity and begin to build the frustration, the inner frustration that will make old age a bad old age, not a good old age. Now, the rehash is a natural part of the cycle of life, and you'll go through that too. In fact, you begin to do it, as I said, as you move into your 50s, I find myself rehashing, talking about things that I did when I was a student in Brickeywood, a senior, you know. Are you following me here? People of age will present you with the accomplishments of the past, and they're asking you, in effect, to analyze them, to pass judgment, to reassure them it was all worthwhile. When an elderly person starts to ramble, you have a job, you see. God has given it to you. You then validate. You then ask them about it. You then tell them what they did was worth doing. You then help them come to a sense of closure. That's the key to success. You may not think it's a major key, but it is a major key that you've got to fulfill. If you'll give me 5 more minutes, because I should close just about now, but if you give me 5 more minutes, I want to tell you about the oldest human being that I've ever met who was a member of the Worldwide Church of God. I have met one person 1 year older than her, but this person was not a member. This lady was. It occurred in 1961 when I was with Gerald Waterhouse. We'd begun to hold services in Birmingham, Alabama, and in Op, which is south of Montgomery, about halfway between Montgomery and the Florida state line. And during the early months, it was my job as a young kid fresh out of college to range all over Alabama, Mississippi, parts of Tennessee and Georgia and North Florida to find out why some members were not attending services. Now, you need to remember, these were the first churches in the Deep South. We'd never had churches there before. And previous to that, tours had gone through once a year, had baptized people who had written in, asked for baptism, but then those people were left by themselves and had no church contact, sometimes for years. Some of them would come to the feast, some of them would not. So when we raised up new churches in areas like that, we were asking all of these scattered people who had been baptized by tours to begin to come to services. We would find 10 to 20% would not come. Some had simply fallen away for lack of contact. Some had gotten discouraged. Some had died. It was my job to, you know, go down the list and find this 10 to 20% who were not coming to services at the beginning, find out who they were, go see them, rouse them out, get them to church, or if they had left the church, take their name off the member list. And one day on the list, I saw two women's names at the same address. They were not coming to services, so I went out to see them. Now, I assumed it was mother and daughter, because the name was the same. Probably a mother and a spinster daughter, something like that. Or possibly two spinster sisters. I was sort of used to spinster sisters at that point in time. And anyway, I drove over to the across Alabama. The address was in Pickens County, which is a little tiny, which is a county on the Mississippi state line in the cotton growing area of Alabama. Anybody here from Pickens County, Alabama? I didn't think there would be, but there are people who do live there. It's a little out in the boondocks. about 150 miles from Birmingham from church. So I knew it was quite a distance, and people at that distance often didn't come to services. I remember driving up a little dirt road into a little range of low hills, and even in the cotton belt, there are little clusters of low hills, and often there'll be little towns up there because it's a little cooler as you get out of the flat area. And I found a tiny community, 8 or 10 houses, found the house, the name was on the mailbox, knocked on the door, and a very, very elderly black lady answered the door, and once I identified myself, she seemed pleased and quite excited to see me, and told me that she had been baptized by a tour going through the area 10 years previously, back in the middle 50s, and that she was still keeping the Sabbath and was faithful to the church and hadn't been to the feast because she didn't have an income. She said, "You know, I'm 84. So she was of a certain age. And she said, "I'd like to come to church and come to services, but at my age, I'd have to take a bus, and I can't drive 150 miles in the bus when you're 84. That's a real obstacle." And so I understood, you know, she was still faithful to the church, and she hadn't left. It was simply a question of age. She was 84, and that's why she hadn't come to church. Well, I asked about the other name on the list, fully expecting her to say, "Oh, that's my daughter. She's 62. She said, she looked at me, and this elderly lady of 84 looked right at me, and she said, "Oh, that's my mother. That's mother." She said, "Mother is 104. She was 20 when I was born. She said she's 104, exactly 20 years older than I am, almost to the day. She then explained to me her mother had been baptized with her at the same time she was, by the same tour, that her mother had kept the Sabbath all of those years and still was. And she said, "You know, my mother is completely lucid. She has not gone into any type of senility. She's a great age, but she's pretty sharp. And she loves to have the Bible read to her. And I read the Bible to her every day." And then came the zinger, and it was really a zinger. It set me back in my heels. She said, "You know, I read the Bible to mother because mother never learned to read and write." She said, "You see, my mother was born a slave about 5 miles from here on a plantation under slavery. She was 5 years of age when emancipation came, and slaves were freed. But she said there were no schools in Pickens County, Alabama, in the middle 1800s for freed blacks. So mother never went to school, and mother never learned to read and write." She said, "I've always read the Bible to her." And she said, "My mother looks forward to the time when she can be in the resurrection, and then she can read the Bible." Now, some of you have never thought in terms of wanting to be in the resurrection so you can read the Bible. But we have members around the world who can read the Bible. We have several very wonderful members in the church in Italy, for instance, who are illiterate, who cannot read and write, all of them elderly people, and yet with a depth of conversion that some of you might find rather startling, because you would assume that somebody who can't read and write is not too bright, is not intelligent, and that isn't the case at all. Lack of opportunity. But I know several highly intelligent people, sharp, mentally alert, who can't read the Word of God. Well, this lady was the first person I'd ever met in the church who couldn't read and write and was looking forward to the resurrection and the coming of Christ so she could pick up the Bible and read it herself for the first time. She took me back to the back room, the back bedroom where her mother was sitting. She opened the door, and she introduced me to the oldest human being that I have ever met, who was a member of the Worldwide Church of God. She was visibly a very, very old lady. I prefer the word aged. Old somehow did not do this lady justice. Aged is a much better term. She was a very aged lady. I remember, however, that she wore no glasses, and her daughter said to me, she said, "Mother's hearing isn't very good, and she has bad arthritis and can't walk, but she said her eyes are just as good as they were when I was a child." She didn't have to wear glasses. Her eyesight was very strong. And I will never forget her eyes, because they weren't blocked by glasses. They were still very strong, very expressive. And I'll tell you, brethren, it is an incredible experience to look into the eyes of a human being who has lived 104 years, which at that point in time was over half the written history of the USA as a country. Now, in my mind, because I'm a Canadian, slavery, that era, emancipation, those words, I'd read those things in history books. I didn't realize there were human beings still alive in 1961 that had lived those things. And she had. I doubt that most of you have ever met a black American born in slavery. I'll tell you why. Emancipation came in 1865, which is 124 years ago. So it would be rather difficult for most of you to have had that experience. You would have to be, I would say, at least 50 and have met somebody back in the 50s or 60s who was at that point probably over the century mark. So a few of you may have. but not many have. Well, I did. It was a fascinating day. She talked to me about working with her mother at the age of 5, chopping cotton, as a slave. She talked to me about what it was like when emancipation came. I asked her questions because I had an eyewitness. She remembered when she was 5 very, very clearly. Her memory was pretty good. Her recall was fine. Her mother still remembered songs in the Yoruba dialect of Western Africa taught to her by her mother, who was fully fluent in the African language, which she had spoken until she was brought to North America as a slave. I mean, the connections were sort of mind-boggling. She told me a lot of things. She got quite upset about an American president named Ulysses S. Grant. I don't know what he did or didn't do, but she didn't like him at all, and told me so in so many words. If he were still around, he would have gotten it from her. I checked on it later. I think Ulysses S. Grant was president around the year 1900, but it was like he had been president last week because she'd had enough of him. And, you know what? She rambled a lot. There were a lot of stories to be told. Now, I could have rushed off to visit some interesting new young member, active, you know, no arthritis, in Jackson or Birmingham or Meridian or Oxford or Hattiesburg or who knows where. I had some other visits from younger people that would have been, you know, on that level. Ask me how to explain Colossians 2:16 or whatever. I didn't do that. I learned from Mr. Waterhouse to give the elderly time and attention, so I stayed on principle. Scripture tells me and tells you that that very aged lady and her 84-year-old daughter were due a full complement of honor, and it was my job to stay and to give it to her. Now, her daughter did honor her, you see. She was living the closing months of a good old age. This tiny black community in Alabama did show their elderly a great deal of honor and respect, and she was honored, you see. She was honored in a special way because of what she had lived through, and they gave it to her, and she was not unhappy. She fully expected me to sit there and ask her about her life because everybody else did. Children, grandchildren, other people in the community. She was enjoying a very good old age. As a servant of God, God expected me to stay, to put in my measure, and to fill the responsibility entrusted to me in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 22, and I did that. And I listened to the stories, and I tried to validate her as well as I could. Even then, I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that's what Mr. Waterhouse would have expected of me, so I did what was expected. Now I can define what was actually going on. It was one of the most memorable days of my entire life. How many days of that type have you ever had? How many? Do you remember any? You know, God blesses those who bless the elderly. You remember Mr. Ducotte was called the widow's elder back in the 70s? The elderly in Pasadena all know that they were the focus of his attention during that period of time. God has blessed Mr. Ducotte because he blessed the elderly. Would you like to have success in life? I mean, within the congregations, within the church, it is very important that you spend some of your time with your peers. I think singles activities are a wonderful time to be together, to date, to socialize. Those things are incredibly important, and I'm all for that. But as you leave the singles weekend in a day or two after they're all over, you go back to where you came from. Please remember part of the foundation. The great foundation is service, but within that context, you've got to take some time to serve people of age, to validate, to respect, and to honor. As you do that, God will bless you in return. He'll bless your plans. He will bless you as a single person. He will bless you in your marriage plans. He will bless you in your professional life, and he'll bless you within the congregation. That's awfully important to analyze and to think about. Have a very good weekend, and enjoy one another, but don't forget the elderly. They ought to be a very important part of your life, too.